This is Q's in the Pod, the podcast where I have notes this time, because we tried to do this podcast once before and it didn't work. Tonight on Q's in the Pod, we will be discussing our creative processes.
And Tofurky.
Should we get that out of the way
tonight.
First? Tonight! Tofurky! Tofurky. Yay or nay, Amber?
Nay. The stuffing was good and the cake was good.
Yes, we got a Tofurky kit from my mother, who apparently was going to have this as part of our Easter dinner. But she didn't defrost it in time.
Or just didn't feel like making it.
Yeah, Tofurky's pretty gross. Pretty gross. It's actually as bad as it looks, strangely.
Wow. It's pretty insulting.
Yeah.
The gravy is horrific.
Yes.
As far as I can tell.
I definitely think it's time to stop trying to make vegan foods that emulate, you know, non-vegan foods.
My mom really likes the vegan, what are they, Boca Burgers?
Yeah, okay.
They're not really trying to be hamburgers. They're trying to be veggie burgers.
Yeah.
They're a thing. They're their own thing.
I agree with that.
And I'd like to point out, one of the most popular brands of veggie burgers is Morningstar. And who is Morningstar, Daniel? Lucifer, the fallen angel,
no,
Satan.
True.
The stuffing inside it was pretty good. It would have been good if it like came with more stuffing on the side for me to eat instead of the tofurky.
So ideally, tofurky meal with no gravy or tofurky.
Yeah.
So what you'd like is some stuffing and cake.
It's important to note that the stuffing was essentially just rice.
Yeah, rice is pretty good, though.
It wasn't just rice. It had good stuff in it. I think when a hollow was left and eat it.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I'll feel better about that. Then we're going to throw the rest of the tofurky loaf out onto the lawn and see if any other animal is foolish enough to eat it.
Yes, maybe there's like a starving vegan raccoon who will be grateful.
So, Amber, do you feel like an imposter?
What am I impostering?
You're impostering that you're an artist.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so mean of you to say, Tom.
You don't feel like an imposter.
No. I feel like an imposter as an adult in general.
That is true. But as an artist, you feel like you are a fulfilled human being, that you're being the best artist you can be.
Well, no, but I'm as good as an artist as I feel like being.
Sounds lazy, Amber. Sounds lazy.
I'm good at accepting myself and my art for what it is.
You discussed to me how you feel like the little polymer clay figures you make are a craft. It's what you do for money. What is your art? Talk to me about your art.
Well, it depends. Like, I think it's more about the different materials. Like, different mediums lend themselves to different applications. Like, my little polymer clay things are more of like a doodle.
Like, it's a physical doodle. I've seen you when I'm trying to give a talk or something, sitting there playing with them and making more of them.
Yeah.
But they sell pretty well.
I used to, in drawing class, doodle, like, you know the silly little swishy erasers? Like the gummy erasers? I used to sculpt at things out of that during drawing class when I was bored.
Daniel, do you feel like an imposter? Tell me about your art first, and then tell me what a faker you are.
Yeah, no, it is hard, right? Because we had these conversations last week, and now we're trying to recapture the magic.
It's true.
And it's difficult. You know, the two principal types of art I make are, like, the laser-etched mandalas and magic circles and whatnot, and then the other side is my you know, depression and sadness inspired digital paintings of monsters. Lately I've been on a kick of like carcass hanging things.
Nice.
Like over Easter I just randomly did a bunny and then was halfway done with it before I realized, oh wait, I'm doing a crucified rabbit with its entrails hanging out. Look
nice.
At that. So,
at least you're drawing it this time and not actually creating them.
True. No. Just for the record, I was raised with animals, so I have at least that tiny level of empathy, and that's why I'm not a serial killer now.
That's good. So you didn't have to have, like, that Dexter moment where they had to sit you down and be like...
No. I was definitely never in danger of, like... Because animals were the only ones that I understood and got along with, so... You know, it was other people that I had difficulty, you know, seeing as things other than, like, annoying pieces of meat. The weird part is, like, the painting, I don't really consider the esoteric pieces art as much as I do the paintings, because the esoteric pieces are, as I, you know, kind of discussed last time, like, a lot of it is wrapped up in the process of drafting, which is, it's a process. Like if you want to make a pentagon or an equilateral triangle, like there's a specific number of steps you do, and if you do those, you end up with, you know, an equilateral triangle or a pentagon, or, well, okay, an approximate pentagon, but it's really close. It's like you know, thousands of a percent close if you do it right.
Wait, if you draft a pentagon, it's not necessarily right?
No, that's the weird thing.
But circles are.
Yes, yes. Weird. Yeah, well, what it is it's one of the things that's kind of wrapped up in the math of it, is that you cannot construct a perfect pentagon or a heptagon.
It's a heptagon.
Seven.
And also, like, I don't think you can do an eneagon either, which is 9-pointed stars. And then, of course, anything derived from those you also can't do.
Yeah.
And it's just something about the math of it. Like there's... I don't remember the specific proof, but it might have been Descartes, who might have been one of the people that worked out how you can make a calculation to figure out if you can construct something or not. But yeah, so that's kind of one of the things. You can't do perfect versions, but there are very close approximations, but they are off by a measurable amount. It's just so tiny that most people wouldn't be able to tell.
Yeah, you wouldn't visually be able to notice.
Yeah. And what is kind of funny about it is so you can't do a pentagon, but you can do a golden section rectangle,
what's a golden section rectangle?
Okay.
Does this have to do with the golden ratio?
Yes. Okay. So the golden ratio is, mathematically speaking, it'd be like, okay, you take a line and it's, let's say it's unit measure of one. And if you cut it in a specific way, it leaves just enough left over that if you cut it by the same percentage, you would keep getting like these identical sections. That's a horrible way to describe it.
Isn't it mostly halves?
No, it's
okay.
like the rough approximation is like 1.618 something.
Okay.
Or 6.18. So like if you take something that's you know, distance one, and you add 0.618, et cetera to it, then you would end up with I'm explaining it really terribly. I'm bad at math, but like visually is kind of how I can handle it, which is why I can do all the drafting stuff really easily. But okay, so if you have a golden section rectangle and you cut a perfect square out of it, it leaves behind a rectangle that has the same proportions as the original. So if you cut a square out of that, etc., you can go on forever. But there is a way to draft that if you draft a square and then something. What do you have to do? You have to go from the midpoint of one of the faces to the top right corner or top left corner, doesn't matter, and make that arc down, and that actually gives you that'll add an amount to the square that's the same as the golden section ratio. And then if you have that length, I believe you can actually use that to kind of artificially construct a pentagon, but it's kind of cheating because you're using a preset measurement and not deriving it from the unit circle.
Kind of vaguely
mathematicians
understand.
Out there, I apologize because I know I butchered that. There's no question.
So what sort of attention do you need to feel like, I guess I'm going back to being an imposter, but I personally need people to be like, you did a good thing there, Tom. Good thing. Or give me some sort of positive attention. Incentivize me. Light a fire under my ass. Do you need people to comment? Would you keep working at the same clip if no one commented, if they all just ignored you?
I don't work at a good clip anyways. I'd be better at, I'm fine with being ignored. What I'd really need is someone to give me a deadline. Then I could get things done faster.
Deadlines are pretty good. I actually recently, as you know, ABC CLIO. I don't know if they call them ABC CLIO, but I'll spell it out. It's all caps when they write to me. One of their editors queried me to write an essay about juvenile justice because my day job is in a prison for children.
Like actual children that kind of need to be in an institution somewhere. Like,
yeah.
No question.
So they queried me, would you be interested in writing this essay? And they told me that the deadline for the essay was June 1st and they would pay me money. I'm like, oh, great. And so I wrote the essay and I sent it to them and, is this good? They said, so you're interested in doing the book then? I'm like, oh, yes. And then they sent me the contract. because I had not had this experience before. But yeah, like, oh, there's a deadline in June. I'll just do it in a week. I mostly did it the night they told me about it.
Yeah.
Because, oh, there was a deadline, even though it was very far away. I just wanted it out of my mind. But if they didn't give me a deadline, I don't think I would have been so insistent to get it out.
See, I have the opposite. If there's a deadline, I get it done, you know, the day before.
Now, I wonder if that's, like, to do with writing. Because, like, I know one of the reasons I don't consider myself a writer is, like, if I can formulate, or, you know, like structure out stories and storylines and things. But it's kind of like if I don't have access to something I can type on right that second, I'll never have it again. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's, like... Is that just the case for you? Like, when you start thinking about a project or an idea, does it just propagate in such a way that you know, it's almost easier to just write it out then? Or
that might be the case. I know that in my writing career, I had to figure out that when I get that idea for something that I'm not ready to write, mm-hmm. I just open up a file. I have Evernote right now, which turned out to be really useful if you were a writer. Please get yourself Evernote. It is free. This is a free blurb for you, Evernote. Go get Evernote. I'll link it in the show notes.
Send us free shit, Evernote.
Speaking of Evernote, I do have to disagree with it being super awesome. Because I had it on my desktop, and I was using it to save things for, like, weddings and art stuff. And I had it all saved locally because basically it took up too much space for me to use the web version because it would have held, like, 5 pictures and then be full. So I had it all saved locally. And then I reformatted my hard drive or whatever. Like, I was having a huge problem that turned out to just be the video card, and I put it in the oven and it was fine. But before that, I completely erased, installed everything and everything. And I couldn't figure out, I guess because I didn't export it properly beforehand, mm-hmm. I couldn't find where it was stored on my, even though it saved locally, I couldn't get it to recreate my Evernote files.
Okay. So if you're a writer and you're using Evernote properly, having it upload to the server like you're supposed to...
I didn't have space!
I understand.
Pictures are bigger than words, Tom.
It is, and that's why it's good for writers.
I think I kind of asked you, like, how the workflow is. Like when you get an idea for, you know, if somebody presents you with, okay, here's the premise, write about it. Like, if you start thinking about it right then, can you stop and come back to it later, or does it all kind of have to get out right then?
No, I think that as long as I get enough that I know where I was going with that, I can come back.
But with me, like, thinking of that percolation sort of thing, like, I don't write, but with art, I tend to just sit and think about a project or something for a while before I actually even, like, sketch it or do anything with it. Do you do that? Like, or do you normally just get it out?
That it is, again, it's kind of weird. It depends on, like, if I'm doing the mandala drawing things, like, usually with those, well, actually, no, I guess everything kind of works the same way. Like, if I'm with, or at least with the digital painting stuff, like, it's very much feeling driven. So, like, mm-hmm. if I've been feeling a certain way for a couple of days, then I can probably get something out, but it's more like, I'll have these intense bursts where I'm drawing and it kind of all has to come out right then. Mm. Like, I can, it's kind of the same with writing where, like, you know, you can kind of, you get the creative outpouring to a point where you can, you know, you start to feel the exhaustion kick in, and then all of a sudden, like, you kind of have to stop because then you'll start fucking up.
Yeah.
And then can maybe go back and do, like, editing sort of work. Although I find with myself, like, I almost always want to go back and change things. And with the digital stuff, like, each of my drawings has about 16 different variations of it. Because
yeah.
I'll just, you know, be like, oh, maybe I want this over there, that over here. And then sometimes I'll think, like, you know, oh, I should go back and fix, you know, Blue Bunny looks really shitty in this one. I should make that better. And it for some reason never works. Like, I can almost never get back into it. Or I can make small adjustments. But if I try to redo something, then all of a sudden it's like I'm trying to make a new thing and
okay.
It comes out weird. But yeah, but again, with the, you know, with the esoteric depictions or diagrams or whatever, because of their nature, like, it's very easy to just kind of, you know, with those, there's at least 100 steps before I can even get to a part that would be creative, even. You know, if I'm just doing my standard layout, like, it's I know exactly where that's going, so you know. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So you don't just have piles of them sitting around for you to finish.
Right. No, no, no. That'd be and again, luckily, because I do most of the work digitally, like it's more like, oh, I'll come back to this file from, you know,
so
6 months ago.
Of files.
Files are very important for artists these days.
Yes, yes. And having a good scheme for keeping track of them is important, because like a lot of times I forget what I named things.
Yeah.
And then we'll find it a year later and be like, oh, right. I remember that. Too bad I don't feel that way anymore and I can't fix it.
Yeah. How often do you pull your art from your own emotions? It sounds like, you know, you have some depressing feelings, Daniel.
Yeah, I guess I showed some of my work twice. First part was as a like collective thing at the Art Riot, and that one I was just calling, you know, sad monsters, because I'd just kind of gone through a breakup thing, and you know, was drawing all these sad monsters carrying around lifeless bodies, which were kind of, you know, it was kind of my way of like trying to acknowledge that the sadness is over something that's not real anymore, and you're just kind of carrying it around, and yeah, so Sad Monsters was the first, you know, batch of things I did, and then my actual solo show was what did I call it, something like Poverty of the Heart or whatever, which was, you know, still dealing with all of that sadness, and you know, but then it had progressed to blood-soaked ghost creatures. And that's all 100% feeling based.
Okay. What about you, Amber? Do you pull from your emotions or?
To some extent, it wouldn't be obvious from my artwork necessarily what I was saying or thinking. Like, I do have a lot of stuff that, if it was to be based on something I was feeling, it would have been something that was from a while ago, or maybe I was currently still dealing with. Like, it wouldn't be a momentary, like, not that yours was momentary, but you see, like, sometimes you talk about how you're feeling the emotion, you put it down.
Yeah,
like,
right,
I don't
right.
really do that. So much.
Well, you probably also have like actual functioning emotions, so you know.
I just cry because I run over squirrels. Yes.
Which is a normal reaction, I think.
Yes, I think, yeah. Human beings are sad about killing squirrels usually.
Except when they're dicks, but
yeah,
you know.
Sometimes squirrels are dicks.
Yeah, that squirrel's a neo-Nazi. We agree on that.
Yeah, we agreed that the squirrel was a neo-Nazi, so
probably.
It's probably okay that she killed it.
Right, he was probably getting ready to, like, you know, rally some of his fellow neo-Nazi squirrel friends to go lynch,
that's true,
you know,
that's true.
Squirrel minority.
Do you feel like you need to be a part of the art? I always say you can't pull a J.D. Salinger anymore. You can't just hide in seclusion and just put your work out there and have no connection between the two. Do you feel like you can put your work out there and let it stand on its own? Or do you need to stand next to it and be like, no, guys, please come look at this. I'm cool, right? You're cool now? We're cool? What do you think, Amber?
I don't know. I guess I'm fine with people just looking at it outside of me. I do. I've had people say that even though I do work in several different mediums, and, like, to me, like, they look different in some ways. But generally, people can recognize my art as something I made, even though it's in a different medium, even though it's different in some way.
I agree that there's a continuity between your art.
Which is odd to me, since some things do pop up regardless of the medium. Like, I like doing wood textures and things. Like, I love doing textures and colors, but I also love doing charcoal drawings. And that wouldn't have as much relationship as I'd think to, like, tiny monsters that are brightly colored.
No, but I think that's just the fact that it's all coming from the same,
exactly.
You know, lens. Like, you're always going to have little weird quirks that...
I'm recognizable in my artwork, but I don't think people care too much if I'm sitting there or not.
It's not important to me what other people think about the art, I guess. Mm. So, like, in a way, I don't care if I'm associated with it as much. I didn't end up doing it, but at my show, like, I have one of those weird void mask things. It's like the spandex, essentially, that you can see through. And I was going to wear that the whole night. I didn't end up doing that because the only people that came by were people I knew for the most part, and that just kind of, for some reason, would have been weird. But yeah, like, that was my backup plan if I had to deal with a bunch of, like, strangers or whatnot. But definitely, like, on the one hand, your art, once you put it out there, like, you don't have any control over how people receive it or what they think about it.
Or what they do to it.
Or what they do to it, yeah. but on the other hand, like, you almost can't be separated from it. Because, like you said now, like, it's really difficult to be separate from your work. Unless you're Banksy, apparently.
And, yeah.
You know, but even then, like the Banksy. Concept of Banksy can never be separated from Banksy's work. Anytime you see it, it's going to be associated with whatever the character is.
There's some story that I was told in college, which I've never actually validated, that there was some artist who bought a lawn chair from Walmart, put it in the middle of the gallery, and charged like $10,000 for it. And it sold. And someone said, well, why should I buy this lawn chair from you? I could just go to Walmart and buy one for $3. He said, yes, but I bought this one and I put it here, so it's art now. So it was very much the, like, it's... Right. Because I'm the artist and I'm standing here, this artwork has value. But outside the context of me, this artwork is a lawn chair.
Well, not the context of him. It's the context of the gallery, that he picked it out, but he doesn't have to be standing there.
No, well, I guess it is kind of the moment, because, like, the difference would be that you could always say, like, oh, yes, I bought this lawn chair for $10,000 because artist X had it exhibited in, you know, gallery Y at this point in time. So, like, there's, it has that
history.
Meaning. Right, but which means, though, that, like, if it ever gets stolen, then that's destroyed because there'll be a break in the link, and then, you know.
And if you want to talk about weird art things, I can tell you a few things. Obviously, the most famous one is the fountain. It's signed R. Mott, M-O-T-T, and it is a urinal.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, so, okay. Now you know. It's called the fountain, though.
Right.
And it's a urinal. It was put out. It was signed. Wasn't signed by the guy's actual name. It ended up being thrown away, I think.
Of course.
I think maybe some people were upset about it, but in general, it has been, the original one has been lost.
Right.
Which was, again, just a urinal that he bought at, like, a hardware store that started this whole, like, buying random objects and passing them off as art.
Shit, even just, like, the other day on Reddit, there was a posting of somebody who was like, oh, me and my friends thought it would be funny to visit this you know, new art gallery and and put my sunglasses down in a corner and see how many people came over to look at it, and it was a bunch of people.
Yep.
Art! LOL.
And there's also this guy, but we saw one of them at the Dia. The pencil lines on the wall.
Yes.
Do you remember that? Because those pencil lines were not created by him. He created the instruction sheet to draw those lines on a wall. And if you sell that artwork, you have to erase your lines and give the new person the specific instruction sheet.
I'm slightly better with that than I am with, I don't remember who it was, but there was like a mild controversy about a guy who would basically, like, in Central Park or whatever, he would have 20 art students making things to his direction and would consider that his work.
That's how Andy Warhol did it. He had
that's probably who I was thinking of. Yeah,
and see, like, a factory, basically. I think he actually called it the factory.
Yeah, heard of that.
And that's sort of, personally, that crosses my bullshit line a little bit on the art scale, because, like, it's...
It's somewhat traditional, though, because, you know, way back when there are artist guilds and everything,
right.
And it was more of a profession, more like a merchant than how we think of them as some, like, ethereal, better... You see what I mean? Like, someone who's been gifted by God. Rather, it was someone who, you know, was a designer in some way.
We'll talk about that.
A lot of the time, basically, most of their paintings are done by their students, their guild members, their apprentices.
Well, and see,
sometimes,
like,
they pick the colors a little bit.
Yeah, I think my like, objection kind of also comes from, you know, my political stance, because that's very similar to the whole idea of, like, you know, a team of engineers makes a car and the guy who, like, drew the chalk drawing of it gets all the credit, even though a much more talented, you know, team of people was necessary to make the things. Or even with, like, TV shows, like, it does kind of bug me now that I understand what goes into making them, that the actors are usually the only ones who get any recognition at all,
maybe
despite
the
fact that...
Maybe the head writer.
even though it requires an entire room of people.
But I love Brian Fuller. If Brian Fuller's name is on something, I'm going to see it. Same thing like Wes Anderson. Oh, it's a Wes Anderson. Yep. I know exactly what I'm expecting. Even if he didn't actually write it, if his name is on it somewhere... I want to see it.
But
George Lucas, you're right.
We're not as much of a fan of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. either, compared to most Joss Whedon shows.
That is true, and I feel like, this is my own personal perspective, that Joss Whedon's fingers aren't really in that.
But,
like,
it has his name on it.
Yes.
Which,
so I see it. Yeah. So they should have some input, even if they're, like, you can't do every single itty-bitty bit.
No, but I think that's, like, why it you know, they're...
But you think more people should be getting credit?
Well, I think ideally, like, that would be the norm, is that it would be like, oh, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or whatever is this amazing thing. And then rather than singling out, you know, who the whatever the thing is, like, you kind of have to go and reference everybody that was involved in making it.
I mean, you do in the credits.
Yeah, but no one needs credits. Maybe title sequences, and only because you can't skip them.
Since I'm a writer, something that gets to me is Tom Clancy. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know how many books that man has out, but he doesn't write them. He writes a paragraph, maybe, says, yeah, this one's going to be about espionage. Here's, like, this paragraph that I wrote. And then some uncredited ghostwriter writes the whole thing. Because Tom Clancy as a brand is way more profitable than having Tom Clancy the man do it.
But at the same time, like, you can't expect everyday people to actually care about who's doing it when it's a, some mass media sort of thing, like a television show.
I don't entirely think that's true. I think it's just that we're, like most things in human society, we grow up expecting things to be a specific way, and we're only used to them because, you know, we grew up in them. Similar to how you don't, if you get out of religion, you think it's super crazy, and you don't realize, but while you're inside of it, you don't realize how absurd some of the things you do are.
But even growing up in theater, you're used to, like, everyone bows at the end in most plays.
Right, well...
Or at least, like, a bunch of plays. Well, you don't know what most of the people did, so you're not going to care what they did.
In plays, like, it's much more likely that you're going to see, you know, credits for most of the people in the production. Except probably not, you know, stagehands and then all the people that actually
still usually see them in the play, though. But you see, like,
well,
even growing up with that, I'm like, yeah, but I don't care about what the stagehands have done.
Well, right, and you know, even I didn't actually give a shit about most of the production staff until recently. But that's changed with, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts about producing things, and
it is definitely like a where you are from sort of a thing. Like, if I was a musician person, I'd care more about who's doing the music in a movie than I do right now.
I guess what I'm saying is, like, kind of the difference between now with the way that we credit things, it is only, oh, here's the movie title, and here's, like, six people that are in it, and that's it, you know, so maybe... Well,
those are the profitable names.
I know, and that's kind of what also, I'm getting at, though, is, like...
That's also pointing out to the general public, like, the second anyone actually cares about the production or anything, they can go on and just look up everyone and maybe... What's his face? The extra who got top billing in some movie as, like, background guy 3. Because most people looked up his... Like, he was a guy on Reddit who was like, oh, look, I was in this! And they rank people based on how often they were searched for or clicked on in that production. Yeah. So he got the top billing for that movie or whatever because of that.
But it is a popularity sort of thing. Do you feel like that dilutes art if you're just sort of...
Another way to kind of illustrate why it bugs me is I used to think Leslie Nielsen was fucking hilarious. I loved him in Airplane. I loved him in Dracula Dead and Loving It. Thought that was amazing.
So you're the one. Okay. I liked it too.
But then he did some other movie that wasn't with Mel Brooks, and I went to see it, and it was awful.
Was it Mr. Terrible. Magoo?
I don't think so.
He did a Mr. Magoo movie.
I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did. But that was the moment where I realized, oh, it's not really Leslie Nielsen that I think is good. Because then I went back to look at what the connecting thread was, and it turned out that most of the movies I thought he was really good in were directed by Mel Brooks. Right. So, you know, even in that case, even if we are still, like, you know, singling out people, like, it would make way more sense to always be like, oh, it's Mel Brooks, and then these guys. And that kind of happens now. Like, people, you know, do kind of look
for... If you see a Tim Burton movie, you expect Johnny Depp, Helena Bonham Carter, like, all these people.
Or even ignoring that, like, you do expect specific things because that's, like, a major driving creative force there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like the actor's art is being a good tool.
Yes.
And so that means that they have to be a good tool in the hand of a good person. You know, if you put a great tool in an inept hand, you get crap. And Leslie Nielsen, for Mel Brooks, was an excellent tool.
Oh, right.
You know, they're basically supposed to be vacant. The best actors just commit themselves to whatever role the director tells them to do. That's why I have some sympathy for good actors in bad movies. Because they're just doing what they're supposed to do. I love the movie Tiptoes. That has some great actors in it. And that is a miserable movie.
One of my favorite things, though, is watching actors pretend to be bad actors in things. Yeah. That's one of my favorite things in the world.
It glitches their mind chips.
What about good actors that clearly, like, are just phoning it in terrible productions.
That's just, yeah.
That sort of brings me to another point, that artists can get stuck in these traps. John Green, for instance, so there's this thing on Tumblr that's making fun of how John Green makes a novel, like, you know, flips a coin, a boy's in love with a girl who rolls the dice, collects, spins the wheel, 18th century poetry books, and is best friends with a albino!
It is dying of?
Yeah, exactly. But that he is so formulaic, but that formula works. Like, don't give me new Coke. I've decided I like Coke better, even though it's just brand recognition and it doesn't actually matter. Right. But I've decided this is the brand I want.
Woo, brand recognition. Brand recognition. It's odd that you are happier drinking something with a brand you have a relationship with, I guess.
Yeah.
If you saw a Tim Burton romantic comedy, no Helena Bonham Carter, no Johnny Depp, happy, bright colors, a very competent, entertaining movie.
Is it anything like that one scene in Sweeney Todd? Because then it'd be amazing.
It would be.
You know, I don't know. I was going to jokingly reference Alice in Wonderland movie, because I think that's kind of what you'd get, and that was just awful, but I don't know if that's...
But
Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter were in it, though.
John Green put out a horror novel, if you play against type, if you explore yourself as an artist, we will destroy you, because you're supposed to be this, like, Hot Topic goth director, Tim Burton.
I'm not sure how often we destroy them and how much we just ignore the other thing they're doing.
Isn't that destruction if I'm ignoring you, artist?
Well,
yeah, but you can't force people to like something that they don't care about.
And isn't the other side of it that, like, Tim Burton movies have been getting unarguably worse over time?
People still go to see it because they want their Coke.
They do, but it's still bad. Like people still go to see sequels even though they're terrible, but I don't know how much of that is just because you're going to see it because it sounds comfortable, or just that that's all you're being given.
I think with him it also might depend. Maybe he's better at cartoons than some live actions.
But maybe he's trying to make... Awful.
Yeah, I didn't see that, though.
It was
not a good movie.
Okay. No. I did not enjoy it. Was going at all,
that's
though.
What I mean by bad. I did not personally enjoy it. But it sold. You know?
Well, yeah, but...
The Corpse Bride?
Oh, yeah. Like, you can buy Corpse Bride stuff.
So isn't that kind of the question between, like, is commercially viable the same thing as good art? And I mean... I'm pretty sure that argument's been happening for hundreds of years.
Right. They keep canceling Brian Fuller shows, and he's brilliant. He's great. I love his shows, but he's quirky, and they don't really know what to do with him. And again, sometimes the people in charge of the purse strings cannot respect the artist. I think of Hero Firefly and Joss Whedon. Yeah. Now, the Joss Whedon name, even then, that was gold. And Fox is like, well, what if we just show this out of order, then we skip a couple episodes, and we change its time. Is that going to work?
No,
and then we'll wonder.
Do it anyways.
Yeah, and then we'll complain about how nobody's watching it because we slaughtered its time schedule. And
they did.
To be fair, it's a good movie too.
Which one? Oh, the
Serenity.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I read about how, you know, we should stop complaining about how they canceled Firefly, because if they didn't cancel Firefly, we wouldn't have gotten Serenity.
But we would have gotten more Firefly, so it's...
But, like, maybe they did it better with the higher budget. The thing is, there are definitely some plot points that aren't in the movie that were coming in the series, I think, that I would have liked to see.
I do have to say, like, I saw both of them, and I actually do prefer the series to the movie Serenity, but that's just because it has that element of clearly trying to squeeze, you know, he's clearly trying to condense as many of these plot points and ideas into something as he can. Not everybody's sensitive to that. I'm hypersensitive to it. It's one of the reasons I don't like TV shows.
So you feel
in general.
Serenity is too compressed.
Yes. Like it's still good.
Yeah.
But
no, I agree with that. That's what I like. I kind of wish maybe it could have been a very long movie or part one, part two, since we're doing that now.
Strangely, like us having gotten Dollhouse sort of to me makes up for it a little bit,
which also felt compressed to me.
They definitely compressed it a lot towards the end of both seasons, especially since they didn't think there was going to be a second season. But yeah, like there were definitely some moments there where it's like, oh, this probably should have happened over the course of like three episodes, and it happened over the course of one.
Yeah. Well, the opposite of the DBZ phenomena.
And I'm thinking about the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie. Joss Whedon wrote it, and but the people with the purse strings and Rutger Hauer, I think, has said, oh no, this is how we want to do it. And so... It's entertaining, but it's not Joss Whedon.
Yeah, yeah, I have to watch that movie again. It's hilarious.
For the longest time, I was convinced that, like, he had nothing to do with that. I actually didn't.
He had very little.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't remember, like, this married couple, but they're the executive producers on every episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Because the only way, he could get the movie made is if he said, yeah, you can have the rights to the character. And so when he made the series, they had nothing to do with it. But they got money for every episode.
Which I kind of wonder if that's like one of the reasons that the Hannibal series it states very clearly that it's based on the characters from Red Dragon rather than Silence of the Lambs. And I wonder if it's because of something like that.
I do know there was talk of rebooting the Buffy series without Joss Whedon.
Mm.
There would just be Buffy and everything else would just be new and different. You know, to appeal to the Twilight crowd. And the internet said, don't you dare give us new Coke. We want Joss Whedon. We want everyone back or no one. Or we will burn this motherfucker to the ground.
Except, but it wouldn't have been Buffy, though, because she doesn't want back in, right?
No, it wouldn't be Buffy. It would be new Buffy.
Yeah. I would watch it, though.
What if it was like Taylor Swift or something?
They should make an animated one.
Yeah, they tried to make an animated Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I guess it just didn't find the market. And going back to art,
it should be like Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Yes.
But Buffy, because that had a fun animated series.
It was very similar from the
probably
trailer. I'll link it in the show notes. Do you think good art has any responsibility to be profitable?
I'm definitely on the no, but that just kind of goes back to my basic idea that I've never liked the idea that art would be something that you would have to try to sustain yourself with. We had that discussion last time. Like, I think there is a slight difference between, like, writing has always kind of been connected with that. Like, we were kind of talking about how it's derived from ancient storytelling where, you know, it's very easy to imagine that the tale teller, that would be his work, is like preserving the history and the deeds and the stories of your people, and then maybe, you know, not having to go out and hunt or something. So I can see like there being a very deep, inextricable connection between writing and sustaining yourself. But most other art, I think, suffers from it just in general. Which is kind of why I'm glad that, you know, the internet shift has happened where, yes, it does mean that there's, like, a billion times more shit out there, but it also means that, like, we're getting all kinds of amazing, beautiful things that would never have existed otherwise if, you know, we didn't have this kind of essentially free content distribution thing.
I'd say it's not necessarily on the art or the artist necessarily be profitable. I think it is, like, a societal thing that society should be able to support someone who wants to be an artist full-time, rather than, so, because society, just by that artist existing, is somewhat elevated as a culture.
Well, like, yes, you don't have culture without elements of art, like.
So, like, it's not necessarily the artist's need to be profitable for it to be good art or whatever, but society should have ways to support it better than it does right now.
Well, especially now that, like, it's labor is basically disappearing as a necessity. Like, there aren't even enough jobs to give everybody if you decided you were going to tomorrow.
Who made everyone not be allowed to pump their own gas, maybe.
But no, but, like, it does kind of get back to that. It's like, You'd expect that as a society advanced, there would be less and less manual labor type requirements and more education and learning and artistic expression. Because, like, it is true that even in the most, you know, take any field you want and say, like, oh, this is as deep in the hard maths as it can possibly be. And I guarantee that there's going to be an art application that will make it necessary to actually progress. Like even theoretical physicists, half of what they're doing is trying to draw inspiration. And
there's this really cool ballet company. They create ballets based off of scientific concepts to make it easier, and they help the physicists and things work things out in their head with their dancing.
Right. It does make sense. I mean, that's just even the nature of creative thinking is like trying to draw inspiration for something else. Of like, you can't solve the problem with a lever, then go and try and see how other things might do and see if you can apply that. Or,
and there is like an odd connection between arts and sciences to some things and like other professions. Like in my art classes, there were tons of nursing students. Like a lot of nursing students took the art classes as well, Which I know partially it's because my college was also big on the nursing. But even outside of that, I've heard of several nursing people who do, like, ceramics and stuff like that on the side.
Right.
Well, so it's very interesting how certain things are connected like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, even if we're not talking about, like, art's intrinsic value to engineering and other things, just as an expression of self, it's kind of a necessary thing. I know, in general, if I'm talking to somebody for the first time, like, one of the things I like to ask them is, you know, what's your creative thing? Or, like, what do you do to keep sane? And mm-hmm. you know, usually try to figure that out. Whatever it is. Yeah, all you engineering students, if you don't have any idea how artistic design works, you're going to have trouble. You're going to make ugly square boxes that nobody will use.
True, possibly. But then we go back to working in teams, too.
Right.
Like, you're the engineer might be good at the math thing.
Right.
An artist might be better at making it user-friendly.
Right, like, right. But then what would be the advantage of promoting one or the other above the other, rather than just...
To be fair, they wouldn't promote either. They'd promote the object as itself.
Like, if you went to the Wikipedia page to be like, oh, this widget is amazing, and then, you know, instead of having the giant name of...
But it'd be like, widget, TM! Yeah. Not widget, TM, by such and so.
Well, no, like...
Well, it would, but it'd be by Mattel.
Well, okay, so clearly in, you know, my hypothetical...
Sorry.
...variation, you'd basically be working on like, a non-capitalist structure, so you wouldn't have mega corporations owning everything. Because that bugs me, too. Like, that drives
me
insane.
No, I agree, it's obnoxious.
You know, Mattel should not be able to take credit for something that, again, literally took hundreds of people mm-hmm. working together to do. And then Mattel just gets to be like, oh, it's ours, we're firing you all.
Work for hire.
Right.
And I had so much trouble, like, I was trying to pick out a cooking wood stove, like a cook stove. And I was looking at two different designs. They were very similar, but I was trying to pick one that I liked better. It turned out that they were both made by the same company, uh-huh. just one company then created this other company for this specific one. So they're essentially the same sort of thing.
Right.
But one had slightly different aesthetics.
Presentation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, there are a couple things that are a little bit more important, and I just picked the one that's probably the newer one.
Well, but that happens all the time. Like, if you really look into the production chains, like, there are shockingly few corporations mm-hmm. that own almost everything. And then, because it's technically in your best interest if you have, you know, two people fighting over products that think they're rivals, but you're still getting the money either way. It doesn't...
Yeah.
You know, but then you're also getting them fervent about the thing, and I don't know. The soda companies do that a lot.
I don't know much about Nikon versus Canon. Mm-hmm. Like, they're manufacturers, or they might be owned by the same person, but I'm sure they get a lot of money off of the rivalry between the two.
Oh, totally, totally. And yeah, like, electronics especially, you know, again, almost everything is produced at Foxconn. Like, if you're a PlayStation fanboy or an Xbox fanboy, mm-hmm. like, there's still some poor, starving Chinese person putting both your motherboards together, and it's
both
not much of a difference.
Both of the wood stovey things I want are made in China.
So what do you think about crowdfunding the arts? Because I'm personally going to interject here. About a year ago, I encountered a guy who said, I want to write a science fiction novel. Please pay me $10,000. Not, then you will get a copy of my book, or here's this swag. It's, pay me $10,000 because I'm going to be a novelist, and you should pay me $10,000 to write this book. And I wanted to smack him through the internet.
See, I really have to disagree with you on that one, because I think it's fine to some extent. Like, they are spending their time. It's a back to society supporting artists. Is art he makes not, might not be worth the $10,000, or it might not be profitable. But I do agree that he should have given swag, though, because swag is fun.
Well, I mean, that is very, you know, that is more a case of whether or not people agree to do that. Like,
yeah.
I'm generally fine with the concept of crowdfunding, but it is one of those sort of like free speech situations where if you accept the concept of it, then you have to accept that there's going to be shitty things like, oh, raising, you know, $100,000 for that one pizza place that didn't want to make pizzas for gay people. But, you know, the same mechanism also allows us to have new episodes.
And the Flow Hive! Yay!
Yeah, the Flow Hive. Or that's more like a specific medium type of thing.
Yeah, I'm okay when it involves an invention, because I understand that there's a cost associated with bringing that to market. But I've written books. I didn't say, oh, give me $10,000, then I'll write this book. Yeah. I created my work of art understanding that I would get money if my work of art was good.
Right. Yeah, but, like, at the same time, you can't necessarily, like, I understand that you don't like it with art, especially the writers, but I have to disagree with that. Because even though that art writer, you are good at balancing having a job and writing. Maybe to write that book, he couldn't do anything else for a few months or whatever, so he needed the money to cover his rent.
Although it does still kind of rankle, because like usually, you know, you'd see a lot of, you know, webcomics getting to a... After they've built up a specific base, then they would kind of do, you know, a public drive to try to make it their full-time thing. And and that's not as rankling, because there's been some precedent of oh, enough people actually like my work and I'm actually producing work. That specific guy, like, that would still kind of bug me a little too, but I kind of lump that in with just, the profitability of something doesn't actually determine the quality of something. Like, a lot of people go to see the shittiest movies possible. And that's just a function of, you know, lowest common denominator. And
maybe, like, how it is important to have a background or something like that. Like, maybe he did write other books. I don't know about the guy specifically.
Right.
But maybe he did, maybe not whole books, maybe, like, parts of books or something that his fan base really liked. And they wanted him to be able to do it full time to, you know, get his book off.
This specific instance, this man was not a writer. He just decided that this would be a cool idea for a book. Okay. So he would like people to pay him.
Like, maybe he was well known for whatever that thing
was? No, he was not. This was like a local author sort of guy that you all should pay me now. Yeah, see, I just feel like you have to put in...
Did he get it, though?
I do not believe he did.
See, that's where, like, me with crowdfunding, he has every right to try, but he hasn't worked towards getting the background or whatever, so he didn't end up succeeding.
I agree with that.
And he probably, like, if he did, you know, get it funded and tried to put it out and it was shit, like, he probably wouldn't be able to do it again.
Yeah, he wanted to publish through CreateSpace, which is free. I've published books through CreateSpace.
Right.
There's no cost attached to that.
You spend a lot of time on your books. Like, I wish I could fund you if I had money, but I
appreciate
don't.
That please fund me by buying my books. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yes,
I'd even
yes.
be fine, like, without buying you your book, like with a Patreon page or whatever.
Yeah, actually that's a like, good
maybe
thing.
Maybe you should look into that.
I know actually a lot of streamers on YouTube have been going the Patreon route, because like YouTube's monetization structure has been getting increasingly restrictive or dickish or just generally difficult to handle. So like, yeah, a lot of them have that as a mechanism. I guess it kind of gets to, you know, Amanda Palmer, one of her big theses is that, you know, if you give people a way to support you and they like you at all, like, they're probably going to try to give you something.
Yep.
But it is like kind of hard to navigate that if you're not naturally
I agree
inclined.
I'm very bad at it.
I feel like the artist has to be a product now to get anywhere. If Amanda Palmer was not Amanda Palmer in your face doing TED Talks, posting pictures of her pregnant belly, you would forget about her. And if you forget about an artist nowadays, they die. They wither away and die.
The thing is, not everyone would forget about her. Like, with her, she has some core people that will care about her forever, basically, that will help support her, even if she doesn't become as famous.
And I think we have discussed before, like, that I think is just kind of the future for everybody who's a content producer, is that, again, because it's so easy to reach a wider audience, it you know, you have this double-edged sword of, it's much easier to reach almost everybody, but that also means that, like, because your audience has a choice, you're going to end up with much smaller audiences than we had in the past, where, you know, again, when there were only six channels, everybody's watching those six channels. So the numbers for any particular show are going to be gigantic compared to anything we have today. Oh, sort of a tangent. Dan Harmon, creator of Community. So his show switched to Yahoo, and Yahoo doesn't give a shit about Nielsen ratings. So he, I was listening to the podcast.
What are Nielsen ratings?
Oh, that's right, because you're like a baby and you grew up 10 years ago. Nielsen ratings used to be how you measured the success of TV shows.
Like, okay, so whenever they're like, the ratings came in.
Actually, exactly. But the thing is like, I don't know exactly how Nielsen ratings work, but it's a very involved process. It's not just that there's a box on your TV that you know, rates how things things go. Like, you actually have to fill out forms, and...
I know that there's some complaint that the Nielsen boxes are not as randomly distributed as they could be.
So they're not a very good indicator of who's actually watching a thing.
So, like, is it mostly, like, handed out to affluent white neighborhoods or something? Is that what you're saying?
And
or...
old people.
And old people. It's mostly old people who are watching TV at certain hours of the day.
Right. So because of that, like, from NBC's perspective, Community didn't do well at all, even though there was a lot of people watching it through alternate means. Because, most TV stations don't care about internet ratings.
Yeah.
Yahoo, of course, is the exact opposite. And so apparently one of the things he found out at the wrap party was that, you know, they got actual numbers back of how many people are watching it. And even though he couldn't say, because it's a protected thing, like, it turned out that it was, four or five times what people were watching it.
You're not allowed to know what the ratings are?
He knows. Oh, we, the listener, probably not.
No, because that's something that you leverage with advertisers.
Yeah.
So you want to keep it a secret so you don't have somebody else come by and be like, oh yeah, well, we have this mini plus one.
Uh-huh. Oh, so they, like, bring it in to, they disseminate it individually? Like, it's not like a packet?
Yeah, no. Like it's that's a
like
thing
you know
between...
what your numbers are, but you don't know how it relates to anyone else's numbers.
No. It's mostly like he wouldn't be able to say publicly because that would be giving away property of Yahoo, because that number is something that they use in negotiations to sell advertisements.
I guess I see.
Sort of piggybacking off that, I get a fair bit of attention from the internet. Before we recorded the podcast, I was talking about how a porn blog reposted a quote from me from one of my books, and above it was various lovely naked women. And I'm like, well, that's great that I'm getting this attention from this porn blog.
Right.
I can't use this. And this doesn't actually mean that I get paid money. I get good attention, but I don't get good sales necessarily.
Right.
And maybe we'll think it's porn and buy it.
Maybe they will. But then it also sort of talks about, like, piracy. I know Neil Gaiman and Cory Doctorow, they're like, oh yes, pirate my books, steal them. And a lot of authors I know say, well, it's good that you have the ability to say that, but if you pirate 1,000 of my books, that's 1,000 books I didn't sell, and maybe I wasn't going to sell them anyway. But if I get $100, I'm thrilled. If you get $100, you don't notice.
True.
So I get occasionally pirated. I found a copy of half of my book, We Shadows, up on some piracy site, and I downloaded it, and I wrote back and I said, this is a really old version of my book that clearly some publisher that I submitted to put it up on a pirate site. Wow. I don't know why. You didn't want to pay me for the book, but you'll give it away for free. And I said, so here's what I say to you, piracy site. I will send you a new good version of this book, the published version of this book, and please put that up. And instead they just ban the person who posted it. But I'm like, all right, let's try to leverage some attention. Mm-hmm. I've tried reviewers. Oftentimes reviewers are really snarky. I personally am snarky when I review books. I know one site read Artificial Gods and they said, you know, there's only one character in this book that I want to have sex with and nobody does. And I said, it's not a romance novel.
Right.
That's so far beyond the point. Like, one of the characters is asexual. So the fact that she doesn't hook up with somebody, kind of the point.
Right. That's kind of like in the not even wrong category of wrongness. Like you've so missed the point.
Right.
It's not even.
So, but I did for a while try to get attention. I did interviews on the internet, and I didn't see any positive outcome from that. The positive outcome I see is actually putting my face out there. I'm doing a talk in Pine Bush, New York at the Pine Bush UFO Festival May.
Yeah, what dates are those?
I'm not sure. It's in May. I'll link it in the show notes. Putting my face out there means that apparently the New York Post might do an article that mentions my name. So that's helpful, but it's the only putting my face out there sort of thing that is useful is physically, like, I'm standing here in front of you, please look me in the eye and buy my book, please. I will talk funny things to you as much as you need.
You know, maybe that is something that is kind of changing, is that, like, in a way the artist as a personality to function does actually need to be out there. Like, oh well, actually, yeah, so I guess that was kind of what you were saying earlier, is like, you can't just be an enigma. Like, you at least have to have a character that people can attach to and
Yeah.
Yeah. You know. Apparently, Kurt Vonnegut, you know, you picture with kind of wild hair and that mustache, looking a little bit like Mark Twain. That was intentional. he said, you know what? Because he's a very straight-laced, boring-looking guy. And he's like, no, this will not do. So he branded himself. He decided, I will have the big bushy mustache. I will go from wearing, like, you know, button-up shirts and slacks, you know, looking kind of disheveled. Mm. Because that's who I have to be as an author now.
Yeah. Or like D'Antwoord getting tattoos on their face.
To the point where you're not sure where the artwork ends, sort of.
Yeah.
I find it sort of uncomfortable when, I'm going back to John Green here. I don't know who John Green is. I know the character of John Green, and I find him a little bit cloying. No offense to you, John Green.
Yeah, but that is, again, you know, YouTube streamers have that problem also. Kind of once they have a certain level of following, like they're kind of locked into whoever they've been pretending to be on camera. Mm-hmm. And if they try to deviate from that, then they risk losing their entire base.
They become New Coke.
Their true selves become New Coke.
When you wear the mask too long, you become the mask.
Yes.
I guess. The true me? Facts guy.
Oh, Zay Frank.
Zay Frank.
Yeah.
So he has, I guess he has several very different shows.
Personas.
He does. But I guess they are all him. You definitely can tell it's all Zay Frank.
Yeah,
he's awesome.
He went stuffed a teddy bear with, like, meat and shit.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, we'll post that in the show notes, because that's one of his weirder videos.
So this podcast has become not a podcast about podcasts about podcasts, but sometimes a podcast about YouTube.
Yeah.
Don't look through the looking glass, Amber. You don't want to be here.
Q's in a pod where we're you know, talking about whatever.
Amber, I have my notes from last time. So, Amber, I have my notes from last time. And I know that your artwork, Gummy Flow, gets pirated a lot.
It does.
And that doesn't benefit you in any way.
Nope.
Because they don't attribute your name to it.
Occasionally I can convince people to, but no, not usually. But even, like, having it up, like, even on DeviantArt, like, it gets thousands of legit views and comments. And I just don't care anymore. I do sell, like, I don't have copies of it right now. But when I have copies, they sell pretty well. But, like, nothing compared to the thousands of views. Like, it sells better than my other things, mm-hmm. but by its views, it should be the only thing selling.
But that is, like, a thing just about advertising in general, is that views, you can't ever really consider views to equate to possible sales.
Yeah.
Like you're always going to get a tiny percentage of that.
Proportionally, sometimes mm-hmm. it does work out that way. Like, if you have one thing that gets viewed or favorited a lot, it's probably what's going to be sold the most.
Mm-hmm.
But.
So, Amber, is Gummy Flow like your Clockwork Orange? Do you know about Anthony Burgess and how he feels about Clockwork Orange?
Not necessarily.
All right, Anthony Burgess basically wrote a Clockwork Orange, like, in a weekend almost. Like, he just sort of dashed it out. He didn't really like it, and now it's all anyone cares about, and it pisses him off.
Yeah.
He wants, like, nothing to do with it. He's like, this is a crap book. Why do you like this?
I agree, especially because I could do it again so much better. Like, I still might, but when I shot it, it's color film, and I did it in a bathroom with a fluorescent light. So it's very green. I color corrected it so much, and even on the computer I've worked on it more. But I don't have the original copy of the photo anymore, I don't think. It's just a digital creation at this point. I do have the negatives. I keep meaning to scan them and do something with it. Part of what bothers me is that, yeah, I could probably make it look better right now. And also that I could have a higher quality image. Like, I could make whole posters of it now. Mm-hmm. Once I scan the negative, maybe.
I get the feeling, like, sometimes I finish a work and then I kind of hate it because I've gotten so much better while I've been making it. I know, looking back at We Shadows, I'm like, oh, I could make this so much better now. I'm sort of ashamed at the 60 copies of it that I have downstairs to sell to people. But I'm still going to sell them. But I'd very much like if I could give in a corrected copy. The editing on that was not as good as it should have been. The editor praised my vocabulary and maybe made one correction with me. I looked back. I have actually a fixed copy of this book. He did not do a very good job.
Yeah, I remember we talked about that for a while in the last episode about, you know, the importance of having critiques that are actually useful and not trying to suck your dick. I mean,
I dated a young lady who read a story that I liked and savaged it, just covered it in red marks. I said, is there anything here you do like? She said, no, it's a bad story, honestly, and just tore into me. And her doing that actually was like a good kick in the ass for me. And it's probably the reason that I got published at all. So I'm like, all right, I can do better than this. You know, it's someone who isn't just going to kiss my ass, basically. And so when I can get a good criticism, I'm very grateful for that. But mostly people think you just want to have smoke blown up your ass. Like, oh no, I really liked it. Would you really like the parts with things where that was really good?
No, I know. I agree with you. Like, I am actually pretty good at giving people critiques, which is weird because I can get very anxious. But if you give me something to talk about, I can tend to be very good at being like, I like this, I don't like this, this is great, but...
Like, I was actually just thinking about it while you were talking about that, and the weird thing is, like, I'm so insular that actually, I don't know, even though I said that I think it's very important to have viable critiques, mm-hmm. like, I don't think for me personally it helps a whole lot, but also, like, I'm definitely very hard on my own stuff, like, I don't... You know, I do like stuff that I like, but if it doesn't look how I want it to look, then, you know, I can kind of use that. Somebody else, I don't even know how you'd begin to, like, critique some of my things in a way that would be meaningful to me, since it's all like, no, this is just how I felt.
I do get pissy sometimes about critiques of my work if I think they're wrong.
Well, the issue I have is I've definitely gotten reviews that were talking about me, and I said, no, I'm not important here. Talk about the book, talk about the story, don't speculate on my mindset, don't decide. There was one reviewer who admits to reading like 20% of Dance Macabre, at which point she gave up because she decided she knew what happened in the book.
What?
And I'm like,
no.
Was just lambasting me, and I said, I'm not important, but you really shouldn't write a review if you've read 20% of something.
Right.
Because people have twists.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't say based on, like, I could imagine doing a review on something I only read 20% of. I personally probably wouldn't, but mostly only if I really didn't like it.
Well, right, but then that would be the entire premise of your review.
Yeah, like,
review.
I wouldn't
like, this
speculate.
Was terrible. For Stephen King's Needful Things, I read maybe 90 pages of it and knew exactly where it was going and felt like it was a waste of time, but that's
or,
all
like,
I'd have to say about it.
There's there's, like, this farm, what is it? It's, like, making money in organic farming that I read part of, and it was just in a bunch of farming stuff I had downloaded. And I'm not going to finish it, not because it wasn't necessarily bad, it just wasn't relevant to me at all, because it was all about meat farming, and, like, silage versus hay, and, like, space requirements and output of different parts of England. So it wasn't even, like, for this continent.
Right. So then would you go and write a review about how,
so
like, the author was
like,
bad for writing?
Yeah. How dare this author write this book about England. I'm not English.
Right, and I had the review where they wanted this to be a romance novel. I said, why didn't you critique the book that you actually had in front of you rather than the book you wish you had read? And, I mean, I felt that way with the other review. Like, no, Dance Macabre has more. Like, yeah, I set it up in sort of a stereotypical fashion, but you have to set up the tropes so you can knock them in the face.
Right.
You can't just be like, well, I saw the first 10 minutes of Memento. I don't get it. You gotta watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's going somewhere.
Right. Yeah.
Or, you know, I watched The Sixth Sense. Bruce Willis is really great. I have no idea what's happening. No, you gotta watch the rest. There's more. There might be a twist ending.
Yeah.
Maybe you want to look into that.
Maybe you want to watch it again and see how everything is, pay attention to anything that's colored red.
Yeah, could be a thing.
Yeah.
What do you think your inspirations are? I don't know if you really feel like we've touched on this, but what are your inspirations?
I don't have a specific... I'm inspired by things in the world and things like that. I don't have a specific thing that I can tend to pin down. Occasionally, my farming is starting to come into my art more. And when I do figure drawing, that comes into my art more. But it's not, like, a specific, like, person or anything like that.
Yeah.
I did get yelled at for this in art school. But I sometimes pin down the internet as an inspiration. Just in general.
I can see that. I can see that.
I also put it as a hobby, so she might not have liked that, too. The thing is, you can look at so much stuff. Like, I don't care. I used to look at so much artwork on Tumblr. I became overwhelmed because there's just so much to look at. Like, I got a visual overload.
That used to be me and, like, 4chan's TG board, which is the traditional games. Because they would do this thing where it's, like, dedicated to, you know, board games and old school RPGs and that sort of thing. And they'd frequently do these character inspiration threads, which would just be pages and pages of fantasy art. For, you know, somebody be like, all right, this is a wizard thread, and then here's 900 images of, you know, amazing wizard art. But yeah, same thing. Like, you know, you look at 60 pages of that, and, like, it it has an effect on you. Like,
yeah.
Like, but that's kind of, again, like, I think what art does anyways is, like, you all the stuff you're taking in, you're kind of regurgitating out, like, what you took from it or what you understand of it.
Like, I can think of stereotypical wizard paintings with mountains and staffs and lightning in the background. I'm not on Tumblr as much anymore, and part of it is because I got just overloaded. Like, I couldn't keep up with it with my dashboard, and I can just get overloaded with art. Instead, I watch Tumblr off over Tom's shoulder.
Yes, you do.
And sometimes I'm like, send me that artwork. That was cool. Send it to me. And then I never look at it again.
That is true. Do you ever feel like, well, I guess both your answers would probably be no to this, but do you ever feel like your art is coming from someplace outside of you? Like, you create something, you're like, well, that was really cool. I don't know how I did that.
Right. Like, kind of like the actual inspiration type artwork. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one thing, I guess, kind of related to that is, like, I've never really been able to do consistent character work. Like, if I draw a specific thing, it's not likely that I can draw it again, just because it's, you know, when I drew it, it was, again, probably from some specific thing. Back in high school, I drew, like, a very short series of what you could call comic strips, sort of, but it's so bad. I understand why in animation, like they have to strip away a lot of what would otherwise be identifying features, because, like, trying to harness the same character idea again and again, like, that's a very specific skill. Like I have a lot of respect for animators that can, you know, take the same image and then make it walk. No, I couldn't do that. I don't know about you.
Well, I don't know. Like, Amber. I don't, like, my sketches and things that tend to be very much a build off of themselves. So I wouldn't call that a specific outside inspiration. But, like, I doodle and do a lot of things just out of nowhere. But I don't feel like it's from anywhere specific. I think it's just based on doodling or intuition or, like, regurgitating bits of things I've eaten.
Are there, like, with your doodling, is there other specific things that you go back to often?
If I doodle with pens, there are, like, certain things. But also with my little monsters, like, there are certain, like, basic shapes. Like, there are snakes and there's, like, big mouth monsters and lumps. But sometimes those are also get based on certain textures and things. Like, I have this pen on me right now, so I'm going to see, like, what shapes it can make in the clay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So sometimes they'll relate based on that, too.
I draw a lot of accidental clitorises.
Don't we all?
Don't we all?
Yeah.
During the Lost show, I talked about how my book Artificial Gods, I finished it, and then I was playing on StumbleUpon, and I'm just like, just one more page, and I clicked, and it was exactly what my book was about. It was all about Aleister Crowley and Jack Parsons. I'm like, but I wrote about this. I'm like, well, now I gotta go back and revise and put in all this foreshadowing. And I went back and I'm like, all this foreshadowing's in here. Like, I needed so very little. Like, even one of the agents is singing Mary Had a Little Lamb, and Lamb is the name of the creature that Crowley said he met with on his honeymoon in Egypt. And I'm like, well, that's convenient. And so maybe I see foreshadowing where there necessarily was not foreshadowing.
Yeah.
But it definitely was startling that this whole thing, this occult UFO connection was there. And some of the things that I wrote about, like the crazy theories that my characters have, are actually crazy theories that apparently exist. Almost to the... Well, and I think part of that was inspired by that I went to the Pine Bush UFO meeting, the United Friends Observer Society, and I remembered some of what they were saying. And it's possible that some of what they were saying was actually just taken from YouTube videos.
Wait, are you sure that you're not, like, a prophet for the Sky Fathers?
Because I might be.
I have to say, though, occasionally that your fiction turns out to be other people's realities more than is coincidental.
What do you mean?
With Artificial Gods, like, little things that you write or you come up with that then are on the internet as conspiracy theories and things like that. Like, things that we have talked about, like, when we're talking about tulpas. And then we look online and there's a whole new tulpa thing going on with My Little Ponies.
Yeah. I look forward to that.
Did that work? Because
no, it totally does. Oh, creating a tulpa?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, did that one specifically succeed? Did they bring Princess Sparkle Feathers?
Yes. Well, that's in a future book. We're not there yet. I'm really excited the book's going to be called Children of an Idle Brain.
I forgot that was actually a plot.
Children of an Idle Brain.
Although that plot occurred after we read about the...
Yes, I found... Sometimes it's true that I find out...
Sometimes beforehand.
But I mean, I live in this culture. I'm saturated in this culture. So maybe I put together, like, these three or four things...
that someone else put together yeah. too at a different
right.
time.
Right.
Well, but also yeah. you're a writer, so like yeah. that's just. I think that's just how your brains work, is like you're giant nets for things.
And, it's and, true.
You know, you'll make connections that other people might not, and then you know, then you get to seem like a genius because wow. you were paying attention.
And you it's get true. To come up with like tablets like an Ender's Game.
But that's so obvious. You know, sometimes a lot of science fiction authors are credited mm-hmm. with how innovative. You know, yeah. you were really forward thinking. Well, no, the idea is there in the ether. Like,
yeah.
right. Well, like, if you apply a certain problem of like, okay, we need to access data and it has to be man portable, it's going to look like an iPad.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes Apple's saying, well, what should this look like? What if we make it look like the thing from the sci-fi movie?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right? Right. Because everybody's, you know.
Yeah. Brand recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Star Trek got us ready.
What project are you currently working on? Amber.
I am farming.
You're farming. Good. Daniel.
I'm drawing a lot of carcass things.
Carcass things. You didn't mention that.
Yes.
Right now I'm actually editing down my next book in the Nightstream series, which has been finished for at least 6 months, but I'm going through and I'm just trying to get it down to 110,000 words. It was like 120. At some point it was even bigger than that, but the publishable length I said was 120, but I'm just taking anything that might be extraneous and I'm tying up a few loose ends that I'm realizing and rereading. Mm. But that's really like I had this week off from work and most of what I did was stay in my basement and delete words. I've yeah. deleted more words than most people write me here.
To be fair, I'm doing more than just farming. For my CSA, I am making cross-quarterly, yeah. 8 times a year artwork.
Oh,
I'm
right.
in the middle of finishing the first one.
Amber, what's your CSA?
I'm doing the Wheel of the Year CSA at Hawk Farms, which is my farm. The URL is hawkfarms.com, or you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/Wheel of the Year CSA.
How do you spell Hawk?
H-A-Q-U, the well, bird. Like, the awesome way I do it.
We'll link it in the show notes.
So I'm working on that, and there are a few projects that I've been working on for, like, years, literally, that'll eventually finish.
What project would you most want to do? Like, irrespective of cost and distance and time, what do you want to create?
I'm not sure. Like, there are definitely things that I wanted to create that I don't have even close to the amount of effort or time to put in it, or space. There is one thing I came up with that would be really cool, maze. It'd be like an art maze / haunted house.
I like it.
But it was like, it's like a maze. How I got the idea was going through a haunted house, which seems so much bigger when you're inside them than they mm-hmm. actually are. So that's sort of an idea. But with, like, art in some of the corners and things like
so,
that.
So would you round the corner cool. and suddenly be faced with, like, you know, artwork. Picasso's Guernica and be like, oh! Startled by the horrors of war.
Careful, I've got Stendhal syndrome. I can't take it.
Or I just put existentialism everywhere. Dada. It'll be a Dada maze.
Daniel, what about you?
I do actually have an answer for that one. All right, so my basic mandala structure is two-dimensional, but it's sort of intended to be a three-dimensional projection. So what I'd like to do, of course, is if I could construct a marble square room, you know, maybe cool. 10, 20 feet square with the design, you know, inscribed on each of the sections and then with like a wireframe of the connecting points or the projection of it. Or even like actually a laser projection would be even cooler. If money were no object.
Okay. Like that, except yeah. you should 3D print a big thing.
Well, that's...
You should 3D print a building mandala.
That would be another option. The funny thing is, like, that idea kind of comes from, like, one of the shitty Hellraiser movies. The box winds up in, like, the foundation for a building, and then it flashes to the future, and you walk in, and the building has the box's designs everywhere. And
they built a building on top of the box, and the box ate the building?
Well, essentially, like, it warped it or influenced it so that they designed it, so it, like, has all the same design elements as the thing, but...
We have such sights to show you.
I bet. I know.
Enter the elevator.
I've been there. Yes.
Go up.
I think that's like every artist sort of, you know, wants to be an architect at some point and build monuments. At this point though, like I'm you know, you just have to relegate yourself to Minecraft.
It's true.
Where resources are infinite and And you can't do a circle because everything is square.
I don't know. I could definitely talk about land-based artwork for a while. But yeah, like big artworks, they're so cool.
Where can you find more about Tom?
You can find more about Tom at zenex.org. That's xenex.org. If you're listening to this podcast, that's probably where you found it.
Yes. Plus, if you want to know more about him on that website, you can learn about him for the past 20 years.
Oh, yes, yes.
At this point,
extensive blogging.
I had been reading it from the beginning, but then I stopped.
That's probably wise.
Yeah.
That's a lot of stuff.
I might go back.
To be perfectly honest, the interesting parts I occasionally steal for my work, like a lot of them put them in an anthology, or I have several books that are either influenced by our marriage or my last breakup, during which I wrote about 50,000 words in 2 or 3 days.
Fun.
Yeah, and so I've been stealing that, like, there will be a significant breakup in a future book. Actually, the next book I should be working on, but that I stopped doing because I decided to edit this previous book.
It's a shame she didn't break up with you in November.
It is a shame. But you can read more about that in Find What You Love and Let It Kill You by Tom Quackenbush.
It's a really... Which you can find where?
You can find that on Amazon. You pretty much can just type it in.
I hate when people like ask you where you can buy something and their answer is the internet. Right. But I know I do it to people, too.
Well, because you
but
just...
it's like, duh, you can find everything on the internet.
Right, you assume that there's only, like, 2 or 3 finite places where your stuff can be found, and then...
You can request it for most bookstores, too.
Yeah, anything you published.
Yeah, Amazon has their tentacles everywhere.
Yeah.
They're like the giant spaghetti monster.
They're like the giant spaghetti monster of...
We are all cradled in... They're giant noodles.
You can't find my stuff except on like
DeviantArt.
Or you know, seeing me in downtown Kingston, you can say hey and I might make you something if you give me money.
See, we need money.
oh, Rhino Kingston, right now you can see some of my pieces on display in the store.
Okay.
Guess that's it.
Bye.
Q's in a pod. It's over.